Do you think your government failed you when it came to the 9/11 attacks? Our guest this hour does, and Richard Clark says your government continues to fail you. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 10 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Thursday, June the 5th. Richard Clark is the former counterterrorism chief for the Bush and Clinton administrations, and he says despite changes put in place since 9/11, incompetency still runs through all aspects of national security, including homeland security, foreign policy, intelligence gathering, defense, and the war on terrorism. We'll wonder this hour if you agree or not, and we'll talk this hour about who or what is to blame for this and what needs to be done. And we'll welcome your thoughts, your questions, and comments for our guest. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Richard Clark is the former counterterrorism director. He was a deputy assistant secretary of state for intelligence in the Reagan administration. He served in the White House for both Presidents Bush and Clinton, who appointed him as national coordinator for security and counterterrorism. He now teaches at Harvard's Kennedy School and is chair of Good Harbor Consulting. He is the author of the new book, Your Government Failed You, Breaking the Cycle of National Security Disasters. And he joins us by telephone. Good morning.
Good morning. It's good to be with you.
Yeah, thanks very much for being with us. You took the title from your book, from your testimony before the 9/11 Commission.
What I said to the 9/11 Commission and to the families of the victims of 9/11 was that their government had failed them and that I had failed them. We had not successfully stopped the attacks. This book is not about that.
Mm-hmm.
This book is about the failures since 9/11. I thought the 9/11 failure was a unique moment in American history where the government had failed on a massive scale and lots of people had been hurt as a result and died. But it's happened since.
What do you mean it's happened since?
Well, it's happened since in that we went into a war in Iraq, which we didn't have to do.
Mm-hmm.
More people have been killed as a result. It happened with Katrina. And if you look at a larger scale, it's happening with global warming. It's happening with intelligence operations, terrorism operations, homeland security. The government on national security-related issues continues to make enormous mistakes. And it's not just because of Bush and Cheney and Rumsfeld Rice.
How come it's not? It's under their watch.
Well, it's under their watch, but there's a pattern here of the system breaking down. The system should prevent or at least flag when the president or the senior people try to do things that are going to result in error. The system should try to stop that. The system should correct for it. And there are some things that are, some decisions are being made much lower down that the president's not even aware of that aren't working well. And it leads to the conclusion that although Bush and Cheney made some terrible mistakes, and clearly they're responsible for a lot of it, that whoever the new president is, unless we look at the institution of the national security process, the decision-making process, the implementation process, and fix it, improve it, we'll continue to have these mistakes.
Yeah. Well, we'll talk a little bit more about what can be done to stop this, but wasn't the development of the Homeland Security Department supposed to help?
Well, those who advocated it, you remember the White House didn't advocate it for the longest time. They opposed it. Bush opposed it. And I opposed it at the time because I thought it would create a huge bureaucracy that would take people away from going after terrorism and vulnerability to terrorism, and instead make them worry about bureaucratic things. I think that's happened. The department has become the most political department in the government. There are more political appointees as a percentage of the labor force there than in any other department. And it gives out billions of dollars in pork barrel spending in a very uncoordinated way. So it hasn't helped a great deal.
Yeah. And what about, you mentioned Katrina is another example of your government failing you. Why do you say that?
Well, we look for the government to do some very basic things. Protect us from being attacked when there's a natural disaster, responding in a quick and efficient way. I mean, we're not a third world country. We ought to be able to handle even major disasters and have disaster response capabilities and plans and move in and save our people. And we had American citizens degraded, hanging out on rooftops, forced to live in squalor, waiting for rescue forces that didn't come for days and days and days. It was a complete breakdown of our emergency response capability. And that shouldn't be happening in a country like the United States.
Yeah, and wasn't the so I'm wondering about the Homeland Security and FEMA and whether that was the right move or not.
So it was a terrible idea putting FEMA in Homeland Security. Part of what's wrong with the Homeland Security Department is it doesn't have a focus. It has too many different and diverse responsibilities. You shouldn't have the guy who is worrying about terrorism worrying about hurricanes. Mm-hmm. And you know, FEMA had actually been fixed in the 1990s and was working rather well. And one of the ways it was fixed was to make it nonpartisan, to take the politics out of it, to take the political appointees out of it, to have both Republicans and Democrats, but mainly to have career experts running it. There is an expertise. There's a field of study on emergency management. There are graduate programs in it. There are senior people who've done it for years around the country who have standards and accountability and procedures. So you could turn it over to the experts and get it out of politics. And that's a theme throughout the book, is that we need to reduce the political involvement in these national security decisions. Reduce them, not eliminate them. I know you can't do that. But now, if you look at Germany or England or Japan or Australia or Canada, there are very few political appointees in their major security operations. They may have two, three, four political appointees in their defense ministry, and we might have 500.
Yeah. When you listed the mistakes of the current administration and these national security disasters, you also said global warming, that your government is failing you in regards to global warming. Why do you put that in the same category?
Well, I think it will have national security implications when suddenly our coastal cities are flooded, when suddenly we have to spend probably trillions of dollars to deal with the effects of drought, in some areas, running out of water in major cities in the southwest, other cities on the coast being flooded. And we're going to have outside of our borders wars that will be caused by global warming as people have mass movements of refugees, as areas can no longer produce food because they're drying up. And like 9/11, like cybersecurity, like so many issues, we know this is going to happen. We can see it coming. It's not a secret. And yet the government waits to do anything about it until a disaster actually occurs. It's too late then, in many respects.
Yeah. And speaking of the other on your list was the war in Iraq, that this was a part of the cycle of national security disasters. The war in Iraq was in your opinion, a big mistake. It was not a part of the war on terror. It does not make us safer.
Yeah, absolutely. And there are two failures here, I think. One is the failure of the decision-making process that allowed us to go in. And the second is the implementation, where it was so badly implemented that we lost thousands of American soldiers to casualties and some dead, that we didn't have to. On the decision-making process, it had nothing to do with the war on terrorism. It had nothing to do with 9/11. At the time, a few of us said that publicly, but we were ridiculed, and we were called unpatriotic for saying that. the system broke down. I think the Congress rolled over, didn't look at the issue really in detail. The intelligence community broke down, provided faulty analysis. The military leadership, which should have said it needed more troops to do this, needed more equipment, more training, went along with it the way it was structured. All across the board, the system broke down.
We are talking with Richard Clark. He is the author of Your Government Failed You, Breaking the Cycle of National Security Disasters. He says there's a long list of national security failures in the Bush White House, but not all of them can be blamed on the current administration. He says there are systematic problems that allow these national security disasters to continue to happen time after time after time. We'll talk more about what needs to be done to solve the problem. 1-800-642-1234. If you'd like to join in with a thought or a question, 1-800-642-1234. In Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. You're tuned to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Coming up this afternoon, it's At Issue with Ben Marins. After 5 o'clock, Ben will welcome in Rob Gifford. He's an NPR correspondent and author of the book China Road, A Journey into the Future of a Rising Power. So talk about China after 5 this afternoon. We're talking about national security and how our guest says your government is failing you when it comes to protecting you from disaster. He is the former counterterrorism chief for the Bush and Clinton administrations, Richard Clark. And his new book is Your Government Failed You, Breaking the Cycle of National Security Disasters. He says that there continues to be mistakes made and incompetency running through all sorts of national security issues, including homeland security, foreign policy, intelligence, defense, the war on terrorism. And we'll go to the phones now and take our first caller, Greg in Toma. Hi, Greg. You're on the air.
Hi, Joy. How you doing? I'd like to hear your guest there, Mr. Clark, if he could comment on the National Response Framework that was produced by FEMA and the National Incident Management System, the NIMS. Very important documents, and I see them as fantastic in putting the best foot forward in protecting the homeland from a terrorist attack and also from a natural disaster.
Yeah, are you aware of this, Richard Clark?
Yeah, no, I think those systems do exist, and if they were implemented in Katrina, we wouldn't have had some of the problems that we did. In Katrina, there was a breakdown at all levels, at the city government level, at the state government level, and at the federal level. And the only organization that really worked well was the Coast Guard. And that's in part because the Coast Guard is has no political appointees in it. It's a military organization. And it simply sprung into action, and it didn't ask anybody's permission. And it moved helicopters, for example, from all over the country. It moved helicopters from Boston, way up north. They were replaced automatically under an existing agreement by Canadian helicopters. And the system worked. Conversely, FEMA didn't work. Nor did the state systems work. That is, I think, a result of the politicization of the FEMA headquarters in Washington.
Dave in Menominee, Michigan is next. Hi, Dave.
Hi, thank you, Mr. Clark. It's a great pleasure. I've been wondering about the brain drain in our intelligence community and in our military as things happened. You know, people were jumping ship, and could you maybe enlighten us a little as to how many people, good intelligence people, jump ship because of the politicization of what is happening? And in the military, you know, how many like generals have jumped ship, retired, and have left because of, you know, the problems that have been brought on by this administration?
Well, it's a real problem, and it's hard to get the numbers. It's hard to get the statistics. And so you get anecdotes, and you talk to people in the professions, in the military, and in the intelligence community. And if you get this recurring theme that the good guys are leaving, then you perhaps think there is a problem. And there certainly is a recurring theme like that. And it's not just the generals and the military. It's the captains. We have an enormous shortage, way below the number that the Army is supposed to have, of good captains. Why? Because they're the guys who are out there on the streets in Iraq, in Afghanistan. They've been on their third tour, some of them their fourth tour of combat, and they're only 26, 27, 28 years old. We're losing some of the best and the brightest of those young captains who someday would be generals, guys who had gone to West Point or in good ROTC programs and really the hope of the Army, and they're leaving. And if you look at the CIA, the average person in the CIA has less than 5 years' experience. That's stunning. And it's because so many of the good people have left, and we've hired a lot of new young people who may be someday quite good, but need seasoning.
Thanks to Dave. Bill in Deerfield is with us now. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. I wonder, Mr. Clark, if you address the infrastructure problem we have in this country, roads, bridges, water systems, electrical grids, and the how that ties into national security, and also the information highway and how vulnerable that is to hacking.
Well, I have a whole chapter in Your Government Failed You about the information highway and its vulnerabilities, and it's another issue, not as serious as global warming, but very serious, another issue where experts know there's a problem, and they've communicated it to the Congress, they've communicated it to the government leadership in Washington, industry experts, academic experts, and still nothing gets done. It's another one of these issues where we pay lip service to the problem, but we don't really deal with the problem. I did not look at the physical infrastructure issue because the book is already too big. But Steve Flynn has in his last book. I think he's done a very good job of it.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Bill. And Stephen Madison is next. Hi.
Yes, Mr. Clark, you seem so close to telling the real truth. Why not expose the culture of deception by telling us what really happened on 9/11? How did Building Number 7, which housed secret government agencies, explode in 8 seconds?
All right. We talk about the 9/11 was an inside job topic from time to time, Steve, so I'm not cutting you off, but it's not really where we're going here. But I will have you. What's your response when you hear that, Richard Clark?
Well, I'm used to the phenomenon of true believers, passionate people on conspiracy theories. And this has been a phenomenon going back for as long as I've been an adult, I've discovered it. Now, I don't quite understand it. In the particular case that this gentleman's talking about, you know, that no airplane hit the Pentagon on 9/11 and Building 7 was blown up by the Israelis or the CIA or something. I just don't understand, first of all, why they take this on as a passionate personal issue and sort of reason for existence and cause celeb. On an emotional level, I don't understand that at all. And secondly, the facts have been investigated by the media, by the Congress, by the 9/11 Commission, by all sorts of people who have no reason to cover things up. The fact is the United States government doesn't have the ability to conduct a conspiracy. It leaks like a sieve, and it's also not competent enough to pull something like that off. So both because it's incompetent and because it can't keep a secret, you really don't have to worry too much about these conspiracy theories. But in these cases of the specifics, they've all been investigated.
Yeah, there's many, many pieces of evidence that doubters look at. And one of them is something that I think concerned you as well, though. What about the report that said Osama bin Laden determined to strike the United States that apparently was not given enough weight?
Well, we tried... Mm-hmm. In every which way, to get across to the president before 9/11 that this is a serious problem. And on 41 occasions, He was given intelligence material from CIA that said, there's a serious problem with Al-Qaeda. They're trying to attack us. They're probably going to succeed in attacking us, maybe even in the United States. George Tenet, the CIA director, and I frankly conspired to put intelligence in front of the president as often as possible, making that case. And he was given a long analysis in August when he had the time to read it. He was at the ranch in Crawford, Texas. And that's the one that you're talking about with that title. And still, nothing happened.
Yeah, you say that President Bush did not take Osama bin Laden as seriously as Bill Clinton did.
Well, that's true. Bill Clinton had many meetings on the subject. He authorized the assassination of bin Laden, which was a big step. We didn't have hit lists in those days, and we didn't do that sort of thing. And it was difficult, legally and otherwise, for us to make that decision. But the president did decide to assassinate bin Laden and his deputies, and he prevented a number, by acting, prevented a number of terrorist attacks, and saved a lot of lives. And so it was something that the president and his national security advisor thought was very important. They spent a lot of time on it. They told the new president and the new national security advisor that, and nothing happened. They kind of got weird looks, like, what are you talking about?
Yeah, and you wrote about all that more so in Against All Enemies, your previous bestseller.
Yeah, no, that's all in that book. This book is more looking at other issues since 9/11.
Yeah, Mike in Milwaukee, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Joy, thanks for taking my call. I'd like to ask Richard if the struggle against terrorism has been miscast as a war, and that isn't this mainly the struggle against terrorism mainly a law enforcement and diplomatic enterprise, supplemented situationally only with the Navy SEALs once you find out who it is, or you know, armed drones that can fire missiles and that type of thing. But it's not really a situation in which large armies can be effective. And I'll take my call off the air. Thank you very much.
I think you're absolutely right. 99% of the time, I think the exception was Afghanistan, and continues to be, where that country was allowed to become a terrorist haven, a terrorist state, and the difference between the government and the terrorist group was a distinction without a real difference. But 99% of the time, you're absolutely right. It's law enforcement, it's intelligence, and I would add another component. It's ideology, and it's beating them at the ideological level. The thing is here that we misdiagnose problems so much, and that's a recurring theme in Your Government Failed You, how we don't have an analytical capability. We don't have peer review. We don't have professional standards. And as a result, we misdiagnose problems. We call it the global war on terrorism. It's not global. It's not really a war most of the time. And it's not on terrorism, which is just a tactic. It is a global struggle. No, it's a struggle within the Islamic world, mainly. And it's a struggle against a certain ideology of fundamentalist Islamist extremists who use terrorism, among other tactics.
Yeah. Rich and Sullivan, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. First, thanks to Richard Clark for apologizing in congressional testimony. We have a chief executive who even couldn't bring himself to think of any mistakes he had made. But my comment at its core is this. I recall a friend saying at before the war what a terrific advantage Tariq Aziz had in terms of being multilingual. And we failed culturally and linguistically in our nation, because even while we're building immense bases and, I guess, the world's largest embassy, we have not had a crash program in understanding this region of the world linguistically. We're not teaching Iraqi Arabic. We're certainly not teaching Persian. As a matter of fact, at the military, we're dismissing people because of their sexual orientation. Some of the people who are best with languages are going to be those gay and lesbian service people who dedicate themselves to something other than fighting a war, than to carrying guns or being able to aim missiles or whatever else. I want your guest comment on that, because I think there's no hope for the United States of America, unlike the British, to prevail with people if we simply say, no, you've got to learn American English. You're going to become an American-style democracy. And we simply go bumbling around in what was your country, acting as though we have five or six or however many dozen people in our embassy who have some smattering of your language and some smattering of understanding of your history and culture. Thank you.
All right, Richard Clark?
Well, I think the caller is precisely right. We didn't understand the Middle East. We didn't understand Iraq. We had a handful of people who had experience there, and we ignored them. We've pushed them out of the deliberations and the planning. And you know, if the United States is going to continue in this role as the world's only remaining superpower and continue the sort of imperial attitudes, it needs to do some of the things that other leading world powers did earlier. And among those are really spend time and money on training people in cultures, in the anthropology, in the linguistics of the parts of the world in which we're involved. We sent people to our giant embassy in Baghdad right after the occupation began, people who'd never been out of the country before because they were political appointees. That's why they got the job, not because they had any skills whatsoever. Not only could they not speak Arabic, they had to get passports for the first time.
Yeah, I'm wondering, Richard Clark, if you have any thoughts on the current debate between John McCain and Barack Obama over whether we should be negotiating or talking or sitting at the table with leaders of countries like Iran and Syria and Venezuela, Cuba, whether you would side with Barack Obama, who says he would be willing to do that, or John McCain, who says that that's naive.
I think I would side with Ronald Reagan. You know, Ronald Reagan called the Soviet Union, which was a threat at the time, the evil empire. And then he ordered me and other people to go negotiate with them. And he negotiated with them at the highest levels. He went to Reykjavik and met with Gorbachev. He had Gorbachev in the White House. He went to Red Square with Gorbachev in Moscow. All throughout American history, we have talked with our enemies, trying to avoid war. I draw a distinction between talking to governments and talking to terrorist groups. I don't think we should talk to terrorist groups. But I don't quite understand the notion that says talking to another government, having diplomatic contact, is rewarding them. No one has ever thought that before in the history of the world, I think, until this administration. And they talk to other people. You know, they talk to North Korea. The Bush administration has a negotiation going on with North Korea. But it won't negotiate, won't talk with Iran. Why is Iran worse than North Korea? North Korea is about as bad a country as we have in the world at the moment, and yet the Bush administration thinks it's okay to negotiate with them, but not with Iran. I don't get it. Mm.
Paul Inslinger is with us now. Hi, Paul.
Good morning. You know, through the years, we've spent billions on our intelligence gathering apparatus, and you know, this last year, I believe we spent about $60,000 million. On intelligence gathering, and I swear that if I subscribed to a $800 Jane's Defense Weekly, I could get better intelligence than what appears to be happening in this country. Now, you know, you have the Army Intelligence Agency, the NSA, the CIA, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and there's no overlord that's looking at the credibility of their methodologies in gathering information. I mean, we've missed everything, the India nuclear program, et cetera, et cetera. Now, who is putting their feet to the fire? I mean, this money seems to be going down an enormous rat hole. And now I've just read where we are now outsourcing to private corporations the gathering of intelligence. Now, who's overseeing their procedures and the accuracy of this, and who's deciding how this information is disseminated and checking on its veracity? I'm just amazed, I'm actually frustrated in I don't know how to respond to our government's present ineptitude in intelligence gathering.
Yeah, I bet you you don't like the outsourcing either, do you, Richard Clark?
No, it sounds like the caller's already read my book or wrote my book. Maybe it's that's a lot of what I talk about in the book. We spend $55 billion a year on intelligence, and every single major intelligence problem we either get wrong or we don't know the answer. And that's been true for many, many years, not just in this administration. It's been true for decades. And anyone who proposes cutting back that behemoth organization, 16 different intelligence agencies, and $55 billion, is called unpatriotic. Oh, you'll make us vulnerable to our enemies. We need to have some metrics of performance. We need to have a professional approach to this and say, no, you don't just automatically get another $55 billion next year. No, we don't just build another satellite automatically. We need to know what we're getting for our money and why we're not getting anything in so many areas. And hiring thousands of new intelligence analysts, that's what they did. You know, after 9/11, they doubled the number of intelligence analysts. Not necessarily a good idea. I mean, you want quality, not quantity. And when you start asking for-profit companies to do this work, I think it distorts the analysis you get. I think it, there's no role in the way I conceive of government to have private for-profit companies doing intelligence work.
Our guest is Richard Clark. His book, Your Government Failed You, Breaking the Cycle of National Security Disasters. Richard Clark, a former counterterrorism chief for both the Bush and the Clinton administrations, also author of the bestseller Against All Enemies. We welcome your thoughts, your questions for him. We'll talk after the break about what fixes Richard Clark sees to these problems. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Hoping you'll stay tuned. Kathleen Dunn with you after 9 o'clock. The nonpartisan organization Free Press holds its fourth annual National Conference for Media Reform this weekend in Minneapolis. Kathleen and her guest will discuss the major issues on the media landscape today, coming up after 9 o'clock. By the way, we'll be talking with John Nichols, who is a part of that Media Reform Conference as well. You also know him as a writer for The Nation and the Capital Times. And he's going to be talking with us tomorrow in our 7 o'clock hour about what we need to see from our national media in terms of coverage of the presidential campaign. So that's tomorrow, John Nichols, after 7 o'clock. Right now, we're talking with Richard Clark, author of Your Government Failed You, Breaking the Cycle of National Security Disasters. And Richard Clark, lots of problems that we've talked about so far this hour in national security, homeland security, foreign policy, intelligence gathering, the war on terrorism, and the list goes on. What's the fix? How do we stop this from happening?
Well, there's some mega fixes that I'll talk about in a sec. But in each of the chapters in the book, Homeland Security, Terrorism, Military Intelligence, Cybersecurity, Global Warming, I try to come up with solutions. And there's no one silver bullet. In the intelligence chapter, there are 12 proposals. In Homeland Security, there are a dozen proposals. But the mega fixes that cross all of these subjects have to do with professionalization and politicization. We have made national security a political football. We've used these issues to try to scare people into voting one way or the other. We've tried to use them as wedge issues politically to divide us as a nation when we should be united on issues of security. We ought to say that these are not partisan issues. We ought to make them bipartisan or nonpartisan. And I noticed the other day the three presidential candidates issued a joint statement on the genocide in Darfur. That's a good first step. But I think when we see politicians doing things, they're trying to use national security issues as political footballs. We ought to object as voters and as commentators.
And then the professionalization. You know, if you go to a doctor or a lawyer or a dentist or an automobile mechanic, you'll want to know that they were trained, that they were certified, that they were re-educated periodically. You want to know that there's peer review and professional standards, and there's a board of accountability. We don't have any of that in national security. We have lots of political appointees, people who come in for a couple of years to get a resume line item. We don't have standards of decision-making, process, or analysis. There wasn't even a National Security Council meeting to decide to go to war with Iraq. Colin Powell, George Tenet both say they never were asked their opinion about going to war in Iraq. That's incredible. We need a process that goes deep, deep into the agencies and departments that is professional and has analysis and options and a real way of training these people who are doing this great work and certifying them and retraining them.
Yeah. Are you hopeful the next administration will be able to make all these changes?
I don't know. I obviously think, you know, who the president is does matter, but on these issues. But if the president just works on his inbox, just works on the current issues of the day, and there are always more issues than you can work on in the White House, if you never turn away from the current issues and worry about the institution and build the institution, the educational system, the language training, as the gentleman was saying a minute ago, if you never improve the bureaucracy, then it will continue to fail.
Yeah. You know, you said we need to be united, not divided, and it made me think that you like Barack Obama's campaign theme. Are you publicly endorsing or supporting Barack Obama?
Well, I haven't endorsed anybody because I don't think anybody would care who I endorse, but I did say last year, that I would brief anybody who asked to be briefed. And Barack Obama, frankly, was the only one who asked. And so I briefed him a number of times on national security issues.
Interesting. It's also interesting that the caller who had the 9/11 conspiracy question, that's the question that he actually said he was going to ask was, are you hopeful or do you think President Barack Obama would change this or make the situation better?
Well, I think he'd make the situation better. There's no doubt about that. But would he do the necessary things to make the long-term investment in improving the national security apparatus and standards and professionalization? No candidate is going to talk about that, and I don't think anyone has so far, certainly not that I've noticed. But I would hope that either one of them, when they get in, McCain or Obama, would listen to me and a number of other people who are saying this. I'm not the only one out there on this issue. And take some time to fix the mechanisms so that we get better decision-making.
Laura in Madison is with us now. Hi, Laura.
Yeah, I can't help but think that we as an electorate are responsible for, well, reelecting this past administration. That we, I mean, you're talking about emergencies. I think Katrina was, I mean, the hope was that it wouldn't happen, but we all knew in the back of our minds that New Orleans was a prime target. Gas prices going up. Oh, imagine that. Global warming. I mean, shouldn't we step up and take responsibility for ignoring these problems?
Well, sure. But the voters have to be informed. And frankly, the media and the Congress, who should have done a lot to say before we went into Iraq, for example, or on global warming, there's a real problem here. For a while after 9/11, the media and the Congress rolled over. And they sort of, we all wanted to be very patriotic and we all wanted to support the country. And so when the president proposed going into Iraq, which was a crazy idea, the media and the Congress really didn't look too carefully at that issue. And so what could the voter do?
Thank you, Laura. Jack in Oak Creek. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. say it's a pleasure to speak to Mr. Clark. I'd just like to say, and I've been listening to your commentary over the last 2 or 3 years, and hope you show up in Profiles in Courage someday. Number one, I have two questions. Number one, how does the no draft laws influence our national security policy about going to war? And number two, are we drifting towards a U.S. military that's bribed by financial money, and they're becoming some sort of a military bribed into serving in our armed forces? Thank you.
Well, I talk about this issue of the draft in Chapter 2 in the book, because I'm talking there about what the U.S. military did after Vietnam, when they spent a lot of time asking themselves, why did Vietnam happen? Why did it happen the way it did? The U.S. military in the 70s and 80s tried to think of ways of changing the military so that wouldn't happen again. And yet it did kind of happen again in Iraq. And I ask in Chapter 2, why was that? Part of the reason, the military wanted to get rid of the draft, but they wanted to institute a system whereby if we were going to go to war, we had to have a draft or we had to bring out the National Guard so that there would be popular, there'd be a test as to whether or not there was popular support for the war. If there wasn't popular support, they wouldn't go along with the draft or bringing out the National Guard. And the military thought that was a good mechanism to prevent another situation as in Vietnam, where the people didn't want us fighting that war. And yet it broke down. Now, part of the reason it broke down was there were lies about the relationship between Iraq and 9/11. And therefore, there was a lot of popular support for doing something. 80% of the American people, I think, wanted to go to war with Iraq. And you ask yourself, why? Well, one of the reasons was they were told that Iraq had something to do with 9/11. They were lied to.
Yeah. So you weren't surprised by Scott McClellan's book and revelations about what happened in the Bush White House, that propaganda was used to sell the war?
You know, I don't think Scott McClellan has told us anything new. Mm-hmm. What's fascinating is it's coming from him. But he criticized me when he was White House press secretary. He criticized me for leaving the administration, resigning, saying that the administration was doing a bad job about terrorism in Iraq. And a lot of the words he used in attacking me were now, last week, being used about him.
That's right. He was on tape saying that you were whatever disgruntled, and that's why you were or why didn't you speak up while you're in the administration? And yeah, the exact same comments are being put to him.
But I bumped into him literally in New York last week, and he said, "I hope you can forgive me for what I had said about you." And I said, "Look, if you want me to forgive you, I do, because the victims of the families of 9/11." They forgave me for my inadequacies when I asked them to. And I believe in the power of forgiveness when you admit your error. My problem is not with Scott McClellan. My problem is with all these people who have yet to admit that they made mistakes.
Yeah. Next, we're going to go to Bill in Elm Grove. Hi, you're on the air.
Oh, hi there. Thank you, Mr. Clark, for your book. I'm right on the following up on this. I remember your comments about how the Bush administration was so eager to tie Saddam Hussein to 9/11. My question is, when George Tenet said slam dunk, was he talking about evidence to tie Saddam with nuclear WMD, or was he talking about the president being able to sell the war to the people, to the public?
If you look at George Tenet's book, he says it's the latter, that he doesn't remember ever saying slam dunk. That's what the book says. But he goes on to say what I was referring to in that conversation was how easy it would be to make the case to the Congress and the American people to go to war with Iraq. Now, frankly, George is a friend of mine, but I have problems with the notion that the CIA director is selling a war to the American people or to the Congress. I don't think that's the CIA director's job. to be part of a White House machinery selling anything. A CIA director's job is to tell the president the facts, to collect the information, to analyze that information, not to be part of a propaganda campaign.
And Tony in Juneau joins us now. Hi, Tony.
Hi there. Say, Richard, I really appreciate what you've done, but I'll go on here. I continually hear from the media and the president, and I believe I heard you say something earlier about it, that we shouldn't talk to terrorists. Maybe you said negotiate. And I believe that there's a big difference between talking and negotiating. And I believe that their ideology is developed by their lack of education. And how are they going to become educated and get out of this ideology unless we talk to them and tend to change their views by trying to educate them?
Richard Clark?
Yeah, what I object to is the notion that a government like ours should sit down and have a formal negotiation to reach an agreement with Hamas or Hezbollah or Al-Qaeda. I just don't think we should do that. But should we try to communicate with members of those organizations to persuade them that they're wrong? Yeah, absolutely. And that's being done effectively in some countries in the Middle East very quietly, where former terrorists have gone on television in Saudi Arabia with imams, religious leaders. And the religious leaders have discussed how Al-Qaeda distorts Islam. And it's been very, very effective, I'm told, by my Arab friends. So, we have to engage in the battle of ideas, is what the 9/11 Commission called it.
All right. Richard Clark, we're almost out of time, and I want to leave you with this. The president-elect asks you for a briefing, wants to know how to fix the situation. He only has 30 seconds, though, because that's all the time we have. Where does the president-elect start?
Get out of Iraq in a relatively soon, take out a brigade a month, that will and beef up our efforts to go after Al-Qaeda, particularly in Afghanistan.
That's the first thing to do. All right. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Richard Clark, author of Your Government Failed You, Breaking the Cycle of National Security Disasters. I want to thank Carmen Jackson, Rob Ferret, and Cynthia Schuster for producing this hour. I want to thank you for listening and for calling in. If you'd like a CD copy of this or any of our talk shows, you can call the radio store, 1-800-747-7444, and ask for program 65C. You can also listen to our talk shows. They are archived on our website, WPR.org. Tomorrow during 8 to 9, it's Friday, so that means it's the Friday Week in Review. We'll talk with two guests from different perspectives about all the political news of the week tomorrow at this time. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.